Hello and welcome to Science World. I'm Eric Felton, filling in for host Rick Pantaleo.
Kids are snacking. They're snacking on a lot of what we would kind of consider unhealthy snack foods. They're eating about 300 calories a day, on average, is what we found in our study.
What are children thinking when they choose between a healthy or non-healthy snack? Newly discovered Mayan artwork may provide new insights into how Mayan astronomers charted the cosmos. And Boyd Mattson from National Geographic talks with a Florida scientist about how he tests the bites of the crocodile. We have these stories and more coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Archaeologists working in Guatemala among the ruins of a 9th century Mayan town have discovered a room filled with extraordinarily well-preserved artwork. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, the colorful wall paintings provide new insights into how Mayan astronomers charted the cosmos.
Chultun was the largest city in the ancient Mayan Empire in Central America, where at its height an estimated 90,000 people lived and worked, among pyramids, inscribed monuments, water reservoirs, and sports fields. But by the 14th century, the Mayan civilization had collapsed, and this great city fell with it. In 1920, Chultun was rediscovered, overgrown with vegetation. Work to map the 31 square kilometer site and decode the myriad inscriptions on its monuments continues to this day. In 2008, Boston University archaeologist William Saturno was exploring tunnels in the Chultun ruins that had been opened by looters in the 1970s. One day, his student assistant, Max Chamberlain, discovered the entranceway, close to the surface but hidden by vegetation, to a room-like structure. Once inside the room, part of a larger residential complex at the Chultun site, Saturno knew he was in a special place.
There are these large numerical arrays, right, just columns of numbers, one after another after another. And this seems to be a place where Maya scribes were at work, that they were painting and repainting texts on the walls. They're in different hands, in different scales, in different sizes, in order to have the calculations present.
Saturno says the painted numbers are a version of the Mayan calendar system. One, he notes, predates the Mayan astronomical tables, written on bark paper books in the 14th century. Saturno says the parallels were obvious when he began to do the math.
The Maya had a 260-day ceremonial calendar and the 365-day solar calendar. The Maya combined those two calendars to make a longer cycle of time that repeated every 52 years. But they also kept track of the motions of Venus and the motions of Mars and perhaps the motions of Mercury. And the numbers that are recorded on this wall are multiples of all of those cycles combined.
The painted room also pays tribute to the way the Maya use those calendars to synchronize human activities with the larger cycles of the moon and planets they routinely observed in the heavens. Saturno says while modern humans keep looking for endings, the Maya were looking for a guarantee that nothing would change.
This is the type of calculation and dissemination of knowledge that we don't get to look at. For people for whom this type of knowledge was central to their existence.
Saturno is making images of the Chultun paintings that students and scholars can access using desktop scanners and other tools. When that work is done, Saturno says, he plans to rebury the site, leaving it to rest where the ancient Mayan people created it. His study of the Chultun site is featured in the journal Science and in the June issue of the National Geographic magazine. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The pace of change across Africa may be about to accelerate, driven by new advances in technology. Peter Heinlein at the World Economic Forum on Africa in Addis Ababa got a peek at the coming transformation during a seminar on innovation.
Africa's big guns are attending this economic forum. Seven heads of state are here at the top of a long list of luminaries, such as former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. But the big ideas are coming from relative unknowns, names like Ori Okola, Bright Simons, and Omobola Johnson. They were featured speakers Thursday at a session on Africa's innovators. Okola is the policy manager for Google South Africa. Listen to her explain what Google is doing with a group she calls Young Developers.
We've set up something called Google Tech User Groups in more than 30 countries, like DRC, Cote d'Ivoire. But establishing a footprint and giving these developers who are doing what they were doing anyway, but without sort of the resources, without, you know, some of the skills around how to better improve an application, for instance, how to better improve a user interface, how to get an app to market.
Bright Simons is president of Mpedigree Network in Ghana. Concerned about the deaths of 2,000 people a day from fake medical products, his firm came up with a way to help consumers know the medicines they buy are genuine.
We've been trying in about six countries in Africa now to create a mechanism where manufacturers of medicines and distributors of medicines can implant unique ID identification tags on each pack of medicine so that when the consumer buys the medicine, they can, with a free text message or a free MMS, that is using a camera phone, verify instantly whether the particular medicine they are holding is likely to kill them or save their lives.
Omobola Johnson is Nigeria's Minister of Communications Technology. She says her government is working with the tech giants to allow people with good ideas the chance to do great things.
It is the responsibility of us as policymakers to look at how do we create that environment that enables those innovators to thrive and to succeed. Google is working with us, creating islands of sanity where people can think, people with ideas can think and take those ideas from ideas into reality and into commercialization.
Ori Okola says the online world is helping to break down social barriers that have prevented some Africans from achieving success.
It frees people from sort of waiting for someone to make things happen for them, which has been a big challenge for young people especially, and that's why they're gravitating to technology so much. It's the one space where you don't have to come from the right family or the right tribe or have the right connections to make it, and it's an area old people don't understand and can't dominate.
These innovators say in as little as 5 years, a combination of fresh ideas and demographic imperatives will begin to revolutionize Africa. As several participants at this economic forum noted, half of the continent's population is under 30, and they are demanding change. Peter Heinlein at the World Economic Forum on Africa in Addis Ababa.
Two California scientists have been honored for their research into air pollution. Mike O'Sullivan reports on this year's winners of the $200,000 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement.
Nearly half of the world's people use biomass fuels such as wood or dried dung to cook their food, and many cook indoors. Professor Kirk Smith of the University of California, Berkeley, studies environmental impacts on human health and wondered about the impact of smoke on the families. In the early 1980s, he was studying energy use in rural Asia.
And during that time, I noted these very smoky conditions in village households. Came back and I thought, well, somebody must have looked at the health effects of this, and I could find nothing in the literature. My students and I looked. So we did some back-of-the-envelope calculations to kind of figure roughly what kinds of air pollution levels might exist, and we couldn't believe the results of our simple models.
Later measurements confirmed the estimates. Household cooking produces as much smoke as 1,000 cigarettes burning per hour. His studies show that this leads to nearly 2 million premature deaths a year, especially among women and children, and the emissions contribute to climate change. Air pollution in one part of the world affects the air in another, says the other recipient of this year's Tyler Prize, John Seinfeld of the California Institute of Technology.
Emissions from Asia will make it across the Pacific, will be in the air over the United States, and even in some cases be tracked out over the Atlantic heading to Europe. And so you can think of the Northern Hemisphere as this big backyard
He says the southern hemisphere has the same mixing, and there is long-term interaction between the hemispheres. Seinfeld says natural and man-made substances interact.
Every particle in the air, anywhere on Earth, is a little kitchen sink of compounds that come from everywhere.
The scientists say environmental research requires careful measurement. In Guatemala, India, China, and other countries, Kirk Smith has overseen studies to measure household emissions and assess the long-term effects on those exposed to smoke from cooking. Research teams are also assessing the effectiveness of low-pollution stoves, and Smith foresees widespread use of that technology when the results are in. He says stoves that are proven to be effective at reducing emissions will benefit families and communities and help to clear the air around the world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
More than 1 million premature babies die each year. Yet experts say 75% of these tiny babies could live if they and their mothers received the right kind of care. Carol Pearson has more on a new report that might be the start of a global health movement.
Go, go. Meet Henry, a beautiful baby who was in his mother's womb for just 26 weeks, far short of the normal gestation of 40 weeks. Henry came into the world weighing just under 1,000 grams at a hospital prepared to care for him. Yet parents Sarah and Paul Rock describe the entire experience as scary. And Sarah acknowledges that without the help Henry received, the outcome could have been very different.
He wouldn't have survived. There's not a doubt in my mind. There are too many things that weren't developed when he was born, I mean, especially with his lungs.
Before birth, Henry got steroids to help his lungs develop. After birth, a ventilator helped him breathe. Henry is just one of 15 million premature babies born in 2010, according to a new report called Born Too Soon. Experts from UN agencies, universities, and organizations like the March of Dimes and Save the Children contributed to the report, which sets out exactly what is known about preterm birth, its causes, and the kind of care these babies need. Dr. Joy Lawn is one of the co-authors.
The news out of this report is this is the first time that we know how many babies around the world are born preterm.
The report also shows that preterm birth accounts for almost half of newborn deaths worldwide, and it documents a huge survival gap between rich countries and poor ones, says Christopher Hausen, another co-author.
If you look at babies born at less than 28 weeks in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, their chances of dying within the first few days of life are 90%. If you look at the same baby born at less than 28 weeks in a rich country, their chances of surviving are 90%.
Many of these infants could survive with inexpensive techniques. One of the most effective practices is something called kangaroo care, where the infant is strapped to the mother's chest. The baby stays warm and tends to nurse more often. Born Too Soon shows that the number of preterm babies is rising, and no one knows why. But the report's goal is to spur governments and researchers to find ways to reduce that number and to provide those who are born too soon with all the possibilities that Henry Rock has to live a normal and healthy life. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope has, for the first time, detected infrared light emanating from a planet outside our solar system, a major advance in the search for life on other worlds. The planet under study is named 55 Cancri E, and it's a so-called super-Earth. It's uninhabitable, but scientists hope that improved infrared measuring techniques in the future will be able to distinguish organic molecules, potential signs of life, in the light from other potentially habitable planets. Today we debut something new on Science World. From time to time, Boyd Mattson will join us with a feature interview segment from National Geographic. In today's segment, Boyd talks with Greg Erickson from Florida State University about how he tests the bites of the crocodile and why he doesn't plan on doing that sort of test again.
Welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, thanks for having me, Boyd.
So you tested on a variety of, there are lots of species of crocodiles and alligators. Did you do alligators as well or just crocodiles?
We did. We tested a whole growth series of alligators actually to start off just to sort of perfect our methods before we got up to the big boys, which, of course, are some of the really big crocodiles like the saltwater crocodiles.
So you're testing crocodiles, saltwater crocodiles, gharials, caimans, a lot of the different species of these reptilians. And you assume they have a big bite, because they chomp down hard and then they drag that stuff underwater, which you know is going to be fighting hard to get out of their mouth, so they got to hold on tight. Were you surprised at just how strong it is?
Yeah, well, what we did is I teamed up with some of my engineering colleagues and we co-designed bite force meters. And the largest of our devices can measure a bite force as high as 5,000 pounds. And what it is, it's like a miniaturized bathroom scale. It's waterproof. It's made out of steel. It has a handle on it so I can hold on to it. We pad the device with leather so it doesn't hurt the teeth of these animals. And it has electronic leads that come off it and go to what's called a charge amplifier.
And is it just because they're irritated, you put something in their mouth, they bite down? Is it a natural reaction on their part to bite on anything that comes in their mouth?
Yeah, the natural defense of a crocodile is to use its teeth and jaws in defense, and so they'll snap down on just about anything. And when you touch their teeth, it's like setting off a knee jerk kind of reaction in a human. They just impulsively slam down.
You did some measuring, so let's tell people how much, and I guess you measure this pounds per square inch, their bite force. So what kind of pressure are the pounds per square inch?
Yeah, some of the pressures we measured for these animals were 350,000 pounds PSI, which, just astounding. It's enough pressure to, puncture through bone. And the bite forces that we measured were as high as 3,700 pounds.
3,700 pounds of bite force. So we get a sense of what that means. If I'm biting down on some food that I don't want anybody to take out of my mouth, if I'm really, really hungry, what's the biggest force that a human would bite down with?
Humans could bite between 150 and 200 pounds. To give you some idea what kind of force a large crocodile is generating, it's about equivalent to setting a pickup on the jaws of one of these animals. So I always tell people, if you can bench press a pickup, you can get out from a crocodile's jaws, no problem.
And throughout all time, there's also speculation that perhaps the T-Rex had the biggest bite force of any animal that ever lived, although there's not going to be any way to measure that, and we don't find in the fossils, we don't actually find the muscles, so we're not positive how the muscles were attached.
Actually, the bite forces for Tyrannosaurus rex have recently been modeled, and the numbers are somewhere between 7 and 10,000 pounds. And, actually, our testing suggests that the largest saltwater crocodiles, the 20-footers today, can do almost 8,000 pounds. So crocodiles are right in there with T-Rex. If you want to see a T-Rex bite force, you can just look at a large modern crocodile. However, in the past, there were gigantic crocodiles, like the famous super croc, for instance. We estimate that animals like that could generate bite forces of about 23,000 pounds, which makes T-Rex look like a wimp.
So the crocodile family has a long tradition and history of having huge bite force. They can snap them shut.
Crocodiles have been around for 85 million years, and these animals came up with a design or evolved a design for generating prodigious bite forces, and they've basically maintained that design throughout millennia.
Hey, thanks very much, Greg, for giving us a little insight and taking the biggest bite of all the animals on the planet, the strongest bite. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
That was Florida State University's Greg Erickson talking with National Geographic's Boyd Mattson.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
We all love to snack from time to time. Sometimes we make good decisions and eat something healthy, like a piece of fruit. And sometimes we choose to eat things that may not be so good for us, like junk food, high in calories but with very little nutritional value. Children are no different when it comes to snacking, but as awareness of childhood obesity continues to rise, researchers and public health officials are increasing their scrutiny of children's eating habits, including what they choose to eat as snacks. Now, a new study from the University of Cincinnati in Ohio examines just how and why children make their decisions in choosing foods to snack on. Dr. Paul Branscombe, an assistant professor of health and exercise science at the University of Oklahoma, was a co-author of this study. He joins us for this week's one-on-one segment, talking with Rick Pantaleo about what the study found concerning the snacking habits of children. How do they make their decisions in choosing whether to eat healthy or not at snack time?
Professor Branscombe, your study examined the snacking habits of children. What influences them to make a good snack choice, like eating a piece of fruit, or a bad snack choice, like eating a bag of junk food? What did you learn?
I think the first thing that we learned was just that kids are snacking. You know, they're snacking on a lot of what we would kind of consider unhealthy snack foods. We usually call them, you know, high calorically dense snack foods. They're eating about 300 calories a day, on average, is what we found in our study. 300 calories from snack foods might not sound like a lot, but, you know, it equates to about two servings of potato chips or, you know, six, you know, normal size, like chocolate chip cookies. So if you think about that happening, you know, every day, you know, on average, it's quite a lot of snacks. Another thing that we found was that kids aren't really snacking a lot. In this study, they aren't really snacking a lot on fruits and vegetables. On average, kids were consuming about a half a serving, about 45 calories of fruit and vegetables. So, you know, on average, they might eat a half of an orange a day or something like that. When it comes to what are the factors that are influencing the kids, first comes their intentions. So whether or not they intended to eat a healthier snack, we found was a significant predictor of, you know, them choosing an unhealthy snack, like calorically dense snack, or, you know, fruit and vegetable snack. Driving intentions, what we found, were three variables, the first one being their attitudes. So, you know, just sort of their overall impression of snacks and their attitudes towards healthy snacking, we found was significant. Another significant thing was something that we call subjective norms, which is basically a fancy way of saying the social pressure that they felt from significant people in their life. So whether or not, you know, they thought kids their age should be snacking on healthier foods, whether or not they thought their parents thinks it's important that they choose healthy snacks, whether or not they think their teachers thinks it's important for them to eat healthy snacks. And then the third thing that we found that was important when it comes to snacking was the amount of control that they felt they had over snacking, which is interesting because, you know, one of the reasons why we started studying this was because we really thought that when it comes to what kids are eating, if you just say that, you know, kids are eating meals and they're eating any food in between meals, the foods that they're eating in between their meals are basically snacks, and they tend to have more control over what they can choose. So when it came to the calorically dense snack foods, we actually found that there was a significant difference between boys and girls, and we found that girls tended to eat more of these kind of snack foods than boys. We did see an effect on race in that variable as well. What I believe we found was that African Americans were consuming the least amount of calorically dense snacks, and that Hispanic and Asian group was consuming the largest amount of fruit and vegetable snacks.
Professor, were you surprised by your findings?
A couple of things were interesting, like the differences between race, differences between gender, but some of the factors that were related to snacking were sort of predicted from the beginning. Yes, these factors are probably related. Let's do the preliminary study to confirm those findings, and then, you know, after we have this study, let's kind of branch out and see what can we add to it to kind of help us predict this behavior to create effective public health programs.
That was Dr. Paul Branscombe, an assistant professor of health and exercise science at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma. That's it for this week's edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog, voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty. And filling in for host Rick Pantaleo, I'm Eric Felton. I hope you'll join us again next week for the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.